listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Bernie will be here in 2 hours. He's heading to Northampton, Massachusetts, where tonight he and John Nichols are doing a gig, and tomorrow we're doing the PDA fundraiser event, whatever you call it, Progressive Democrats of America. And tomorrow night I'll be doing a book signing and talk along with David Pakman for WHMP listeners and anybody who happens to show up. So anyhow, that's what's coming up. It's going to be in the parlor room, by the way, Saturday night, my gig. And I'm not sure where Bernie's gig is tonight, but we'll ask him when he gets on. But he's going to be here in 2 hours. So for the first 2 hours, actually, Steve Cohen is going to drop by at the beginning of the next hour. I want to get an update from him on his thoughts on what's going on in Russia, Ukraine, and whatnot. This is a real hot spot. Here's an interesting, but meanwhile, there's just some fascinating stuff. I just blew my mind. And, you know, first of all, it's Anything Goes Friday, so feel free to call in about anything. I mean, you know, if you've got theories about why the Republicans, you know, put the satanic star on their logo, that's fine. It's whatever you want to talk about. But, you know, that said, remember back in 2009, January 20th, 2009, the night that President Obama was first sworn in. I was there the day he was sworn in. In fact, I was probably one of three or four members of the press who was physically closest to him. Ellen Ratner has some strings she can pull in this town, and we were broadcasting our show live from the inauguration. And I was 60 feet from the president as he was sworn in, if that. And well, maybe 60 yards. No, it was more like 60 feet. And I kept watching George W. Bush sitting behind him making faces. I figured that was going to be all over the international news. I was so surprised that nobody picked up the grimaces and the faces and the silly flipper applause stuff that George W. Bush was doing, you know, when Obama would make a line that basically was a critique of the Bush administration. But anyhow, that was the day that President Obama was sworn in as president of the United States. For the first time, our first black president, our first president, well, I was going to say our first president who'd campaigned on a really progressive platform since Harry Truman, but really Bill Clinton campaigned on a progressive platform. He didn't govern on one, but his New Covenant speech was very, very progressive. Someday I'm going to have to read that on the air or just play a clip of it. But as Obama was, and then that night after Ellen, God bless her, got me in with the International Press Corps, and I'm sitting right there with BBC and AFP and Al Jazeera and everybody else, you know, the very closest to the president. From back then, our show was noon to 3 Eastern time, and he was sworn in right around noon or 1 o'clock, as I recall. So we're sitting there, you know, looking at this ocean of people. And the swearing in. She also got me tickets to the inaugural ball. In fact, I was her, I don't want to say date, but, you know, Ellen and I went to the inaugural ball together. Chalene was, Ellen's wife was someplace. And, you know, I don't know if she was still a pilot for United or if she was in medical school at that point. And my wife, Louise, was back in Portland. She really had no interest in all this stuff. And, well, she had an interest in me, but didn't want to go to the ball. So I'm there with Ellen at Union Station. There were 7 balls, as I recall, that night. And the president, the vice president, just went to each one. And Brock and Michelle come out and dance. And, you know, we're all dancing. And Joe Biden and his wife come out. And Joe, of course, couldn't resist giving a little speech. And then he dances. And it was just, it was sweet. And little did we know that just actually in the building behind the building that Louise and I a few months later would move into, actually, yeah, maybe a year later, would move into at the corner of 8th Street and actually at the corner of 9th Street and D, Northwest, here in Washington, D.C., in a restaurant called the Caucus Room. there was a group of Republican members of Congress who had reserved a private room, and along with Frank Luntz and Newt Gingrich, the following members of Congress sat down and decided what they were going to do over the next 4 years to destroy the first black president of the United States. And on this list was Paul Ryan, Eric Cantor, Kevin McCarthy, Jeb Hensarling, Pete Hoekstra, Dan Lundgren, Jim DeMint, John Kyle, Tom Coburn, John Ensig, Bob Corker, and perhaps most significantly, Pete Sessions. And the reason I say most significantly was because afterwards, Pete Sessions was one of the few guys who talked about it. I mean, Newt came on this program. Those of you who are regular listeners know, it's been almost a year ago now. He came on this program, and I said, Newt, were you at this meeting? And did you guys plot to basically destroy Obama's presidency? And Newt was like, yeah, I was at the meeting, and of course we did. That we're the loyal opposition. That's what the opposition is supposed to do. We wouldn't be the opposition if we didn't do it. So, Pete Sessions, the Republican from Texas, here's what he said a few months later in March of 2009 in an interview with the National Journal about how they had decided that they were going to take down the White House, how they were going to take down Obama. And I quote, Taliban insurgency. We understand perhaps a little more because of the Taliban. Insurgency is the way they went about systematically understanding how to disrupt and change a person's entire processes. And these Taliban are an example of how you go about to change a person from their messaging, to their operations, to their frontline message. And we need to understand that insurgency may be required when dealing with the other side. In other words, the Democrats and the president. If the Democrats do not give us these options or opportunities, then we will become the insurgency. I think insurgency is a mindset and an attitude that we're going to have to search for and find ways to get our message out and to be prepared to see things for what they are rather than trying to do something about them. Congressman Kevin McCarthy, who was there, said, we've got to challenge them on every single bill, show united and unyielding opposition to the president's policies. Keep in mind, at that moment, that night, that month, 700,000 jobs were lost. These guys all voted for the Bush-Cheney stimulus in 2008. They all voted for the bailing out Bear Stearns. They all voted for the bailing out AIG. They all voted for the September TARP. They all voted for the October TARP. That was all under Bush. So you can imagine how surprised I was when last night on C-SPAN, I turn it on. You can pull audio out of my computer, right, Shane? I turn it on, and sure enough, here's Pete Sessions standing in the well of the House talking to the House of Representatives.
Failures or weaknesses in a system that we need to work on together. Four Americans' lives were not only at stake, but the reputation of the United States of America was on the line. Terrible things happened. Worse things could have happened also.
This is him pitching
and
the Select Committee.
The United States Congress
on Benghazi
to have oversight to work on these issues is, I believe, an important national security object. We are here today because President Barack Obama and his administration are not forthright or interested in working with official members of the United States House of Representatives.
There you go. That's Pete Sessions, the guy who said he was going to become the Taliban, being the Taliban against the Obama administration. And meanwhile, I get in my email today from Epic Media, one of the PR firms here in town for the right-wingers, talk show host Bob McNeil available. On the topic, will Benghazi hearings lead to impeachment of Barack Obama? They've already started it. They're doing it on right-wing talk radio as we speak.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Every talk show host in America just got this email. Will Benghazi hearings lead to impeachment? Incredible. It's the Clinton playbook all over again. But that said, you know, enough of that rant, I suppose. Although I could play some more of Pete Sessions, but it's the same stuff. You know, he's like, you know, there's nothing political about this. I mean, he came around and said, there's no politics here. This is about four dead guys. Oh, really? And intelligence failures and cover-ups. And I'm like, what about 9/11? What about Iraq? What about the 13 embassy bombings and killings that happened during the Bush administration? No, we're not going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the one that happened when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, because it's all about Hillary Clinton. Trust me, this is all about, I mean, it's about Obama. It's about paralyzing the Obama administration. It's about changing the subject away from the Republicans refusing to expand Medicaid, changing the subject away from the Republicans refusing to extend unemployment benefits, to change the subject away from the Republicans refusing to change our trade policies or our tax policies so that we get our jobs back. It's all of that. Anyhow, enough of my rants. John in Los Angeles, listening on Free Speech TV. Hey, John, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. This goes right to your point. I don't know if you heard John Boehner's comment about the VA hospital, VA affairs scandal.
Yeah, he said it's systemic and deep and we need to look into it. I thought it was actually a fairly rational comment.
But he also says I don't believe that just changing someone at the top is going to actually get to the solutions
right.
that many of us are looking for.
Right.
But what are they trying to do to Obama?
Right. Well, of course. Boehner was being rational about the VA, because I think he knows that if he just goes off crazy, he's going to have a lot of veterans really angry with him. Most veterans actually like the VA, and
yeah.
you know there are problems at the VA, and they are longstanding and systemic, and the Republicans refusing to vote for more money for the VA isn't helping any. But
and they didn't vote for more money for the security of the outposts or embassies.
No, in fact, they turned down the security
yeah.
requests. They specifically. The Obama administration and Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, asked Congress for more money for security for embassies, and the House of Representatives, the Republican-controlled House of Representatives, turned it down. But that's not going to be in these hearings, because this kangaroo court that these guys set up, that John Boehner set up this morning or last night, whenever it was, when Pete Sessions was given this speech, this kangaroo court is going to have, was it 9 or 7? 7 and 5. Okay, 7 Republicans. And they're offering 5 Democratic seats, but the only person on the committee who will have the power to subpoena witnesses will be the chairman. And the chairman is going to be Trey Gowdy, who used to be a federal prosecutor. And this is a guy who really knows how to get up and pitch to a jury. And he knows how to make a case. And he is going to be making a case for impeachment. You mark my words.
All right. But can't the Democrats raise these issues in the hearings?
The chairman can, as Daryl Issa did to Elijah Cummings the other day, can just say, you know, your time, you know, I'm declaring this hearing over, cut his mic.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. I mean, this is why not just Democrats, but the media are calling this a kangaroo court. This is a kangaroo court. This is as bad as it gets. John, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Anything Goes Friday. Bernie will be with us in an hour and a half. So Pete Sessions, one of the traitors who conspired to bring down, to lock up, to seize up the United States government for years, to make the economy bad, to hurt middle class people, so that people would be upset enough that they would elect Republicans because they would blame it on the president, so that Obama would have a failed presidency. Pete Sessions on the floor of the House saying, oh, this is not about politics. No, this is about getting to the bottom of what happened in Benghazi. Why don't we get to the bottom of what happened at 9/11? Why is it that George Bush was informed on August 6th, more than a month before September 11th, that bin Laden was going to strike inside the United States? And he was clearly so frightened by that he refused to go back to Washington, D.C. He took the longest vacation in the history of the presidency. And then when it was over and he was supposed to go back to work, he refused to go back to D.C. He knew something was coming. I personally don't think he knew what was coming, but he knew something was coming, and he didn't want to be in town when it happened. What did he do? He went to Florida. His brother put the entire state on lockdown. And he's sitting there reading My Pet Goat to a classroom of seven-year-olds when it happens. And he sits there for seven long minutes thinking to himself, oh, my God. I really should have done something about this. And here's Pete Sessions. And, I mean, this is just incredible. Here's this, the press release. Evidence that a major deception occurred around this. Every talk show host in the country got this. It was sent out at 1:51 p.m. today from Epic Media. Evidence that a major deception occurred around the murderous attack on the American consulate in Benghazi on September 11, 2012 has reached such a critical mass that Congress is finally establishing a select committee to investigate. A batch of emails released 19 months after the attack have broken the camel's back, emails that decisively reveal the administration as blatantly and consciously lying to the American people. One of the emails has top White House National Security aide Ben Rhodes telling UN Ambassador Susan Rice to claim the attack was because of a spontaneous demonstration. Quote, but if the committee opens the case wide open, end quote, notes Texas executive and 2016 American Citizens Party presidential candidate Bob McNeil, quote, then the Congress will have no choice but to impeach the president, end quote. This will require that the committee investigate such issues as whether Obama deliberately armed Islamic terrorists in Libya and Syria in the lead up to the attack. Huh. Were we arming the opposition? Well, yeah, actually, I think we were. The committee should investigate whether the Obama administration armed and trained the Islamic terrorists who conducted the killings in Benghazi. Did Obama deliberately hand Libya over to Al-Qaeda-connected terrorists? Was the Benghazi consulate used to funnel arms to jihadists in Libya and Syria, as many lawmakers had suggested? Were terror laws violated? It is actually a small possibility. This was a CIA station. It was a CIA area. We were trying to arm the opposition to Gaddafi. But was this after or before Gaddafi had fallen? Well, I guess it doesn't. It was after, yeah. But I guess it doesn't matter, because if we armed the opposition, but the committee should also ask where the Obama administration derived its constitutional authority to launch the Libyan war in the first place. Congress was not given the opportunity to vote, was not consulted, and was not notified until a week after the hostilities had been launched. In the aftermath of the attack, the administration has withheld documents and information requested by our elected representatives in Congress, and this, in and of itself, is an impeachable offense. Ta-da. Don't say I didn't predict this back in 2009 when we first discovered that Eric Cantor and Paul Ryan and Kevin McCarthy and these guys and Pete Sessions were conspiring to destroy the presidency of Barack Obama, and in the process, the middle class of America. Don't say I didn't tell you. Chris in Seattle. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hey, what's going on, Tom? Happy Friday. Just really quick, you had that caller, he posted up on YouTube with the, he claimed that Pabst Law Firm had all these, like, uncredentialed or, like, not top 50 law schools. He claimed he was adjunct faculty at some law school. The talking points that he was reciting was exactly the talking points that they had a guest on Alex Jones's program that same day that he called into your program. And it was the FCC chairman under the Reagan administration that blew up the Fairness Doctrine. Word for word, he recited everything Alex's guest had said on your program. But he's not here to defend himself, so
yeah.
So I know you probably don't want to comment on that. Secondly,
well, I don't even know his name, I will comment on that. That's very interesting, and I'm not surprised. I mean, we get trolls who call the show. Well, there's not a lot you can do about it. You know, occasionally they're so bad I can flag them, and our software doesn't let them through in the future. But what can you do?
My big point was, though, the other day I'd called in, you were having trouble getting your ID, and I'm in a very similar situation. I know you lived in Oregon for, several years, and that's where I'm from. And Oregon, I think it was in 2005, they passed legislation that made it so that I think every 8 years that you had to go renew your license, you had to present your birth certificate. So you couldn't get grandfathered in. You went in initially and, you presented it. You had to present it again. And the rationale was, at least the Republicans in the legislature, said that, well, it would prevent drivers or illegal aliens from getting driver's licenses. And so I'm sort of in this lingo right now where I'm trying to get a birth certificate, and I'm not able to get one from I was born in Texas. Texas is requiring that I send them an ID to get
the birth certificate, and I'm trying to get, you know, an ID, and I have to use a birth certificate. Anyway, I think that even if you have even these Republican state legislatures that might not, like, directly, you know, pass these voter ID laws, they could use, like, other fringe, like, AstroTurf issues, you know, the anti-illegal immigration crowd, to, you know, pass these laws that, like,
You're right.
You got to present your birth certificate every 4 years. So it's like...
That ends up making it harder for people to vote. Yeah, I'm with you. Chris, you're absolutely right. Thanks for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
28 minutes past the hour. I just thought it was so ironic that Pete Sessions was the guy making the sales pitch for this thing, but it's Anything Goes Friday, so we can anything you want to talk about, we're here. Oh, this is hysterical. By the way, John Boehner repeatedly asked last night, do you really think Republicans should be doing fundraising on Benghazi? Kept saying, not going to answer that question. No, not going to answer that question. One of the ISPs out there, this neocities.org, NEOCITIES.org, which is a good local ISP. They provide really good, high-quality Internet service to people who are looking for an Internet service provider. They have throttled the FCC's website and speeds to 28.8K and have said, until the FCC pays us, we will not raise the speed. Take that, Tom Wheeler. Amazing. So anyhow, back to your calls. John in Jeffersonville, Ohio. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, hey, a few months ago, you guys were trying to come up with a name for capitalism.
Yeah.
And I was thinking capitalism. You know, they capture regulatory agents. They capture they're capturing the banks.
Capturism. So it's like, you know, like regulatory capture is one of the great wet dreams of capitalism. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
The second thing, like, what is the thing with Republicans and bridges? They wanted a bridge to nowhere, and then they have a perfectly good bridge in New Jersey, but they don't want anybody to go across it. John Boehner had a bridge going from Ohio to Kentucky, where you know, our Senate Minority Leader is, and they can't get that bridge fixed.
Right.
And we have bridges falling down all over the country, and they don't want to fix them. What's up with that?
Well, they want to make life as miserable as possible for average working people so that those people will assume that because President Obama is the president of the United States and he's a Democrat, and that the Democrats and the president are responsible for their lives being miserable. And as the economy gets worse and as life gets worse, and cutting off long-term unemployment benefits, for example, has slowed down the economy. It's, you know, people, it's knocked people out of the labor market. I mean, there's lots and lots of things that the Republicans have done to make the economy worse ever since Pete Sessions and these guys had this meeting the night that Obama was first sworn in, you know, 8 years ago, 6 years ago. And there's a lot that they have done to make the economy worse. And then they go on TV and brag about what they've done and under the guise of complaining about the Obama administration. This is their campaign. Their campaign for 2014 is going to be made up of two things. Number one, look at how bad the economy is. They've given up on Obamacare. They, you know, that's working. So they're going to, they might mention it in passing, like, you know, it's badly implemented and it's hurting the economy. But number one, they're going to say, look at how bad the economy is, which of course they're bragging about. And number two, they're going to say, this is a scandal ridden administration. This is like the Clinton administration. It's Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky all over again. Only this time it's Hillary Clinton and Benghazi. And they're looking for other things that they can tar Hillary Clinton with as well. The new one, and the one that right-wing talk radio, I get the talking points, right? I can tell you, every right-wing talk radio show in America today is going to be talking about the fact that Boko Haram, this Islamic fundamentalist group in Nigeria that has captured these 300-plus young teenage girls who, and, you know, the name of the group means no more Western education. They don't want girls going to school. That group was not classified as a terrorist organization while Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. It was only done earlier this year, after Hillary Clinton left as Secretary of State. While she was Secretary of State, they did designate the three leaders of the group as terrorists, but they didn't want to elevate the entire group to terrorist organization because they were concerned. They had a variety of concerns. One, the Nigerian military is not the nicest in the world, and they were concerned about, you know, adding to the brutality of that. Number two, they didn't want to elevate the status of this group. You know, in hindsight, it might have been a mistake. I don't know. It's hard to second guess the State Department. But that they're going to go after Hillary Clinton on that too. That's going to be the next one. So that's where they're going, John. Mike in St. Clair Shores, Michigan, listening to WDTW. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, Tom, you're great, and I hope we all get better.
There you go. What's up, Mike?
Yeah, I'm calling about the postal collecting the food tomorrow, the non-perishable food items.
Oh, I had forgotten about that. Is tomorrow the day that the post office collects cans and things?
Yes, the National Association of Letter Carriers. We come and we pick up from every door. Whoever leaves any food for the people, and it goes to the local food pantries.
Oh, that's great. And this is nationwide?
This is nationwide. So Okay. Everybody remember to put something out there tomorrow for your postal carrier to pick up.
Okay. Thank you for that reminder, Mike. I'll have to, when I get home tonight, Louise and I will have to go through and see if, well, actually, I'm not going to get home tonight. I've got to get on a plane tonight. But I'll ask Louise to try to remember to do it, and we'll stick something out there by the mailbox. Thank you, Mike. Appreciate the call. Dave in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Yeah, Tom, a week or so ago, you mentioned a tariff of 30% on imports.
Yeah, which is the average that the U.S. had between the George Washington and the Ronald Reagan administrations. It was averaged around 30%. It peaked around 34-35%, I think, just during and after World War II.
Yeah, and then 3 or 4 weeks ago, you mentioned a value-added tax.
Right, a VAT tax.
Of taxing imports at each stage of sale.
Of manufacture, yes.
Pardon me?
You tax it at during the process of manufacture. Every time a product is increased in value, you tax the increase in value. So when pig iron is made into sheet steel, its value is increased, so you tax the increase in value. If the value went up by a dollar, a ton, then you tax that by a penny a ton or whatever, you know, whatever the tax is. And then when the sheet steel is made into the door of a car, its value has increased. You tax that increase in value. So every stage of manufacture has a small tax associated with it. And in aggregate, it averages out to around 16.7, I think, is the VAT tax that Germany has. And but it's a tax that's invisible. When you walk into the store to buy that Mercedes in Germany, it doesn't say you have to pay 16.7% VAT tax. It's already been paid by the manufacturers all along the way. But the way that Germany uses this is they say if you're outside Germany and you want to buy a Mercedes, the VAT tax is only intended to be paid by Germans. And so if an American wants to buy a Mercedes from Germany or a Toyota from Japan that's manufactured in Japan, even through a U.S. dealership, we're going to reverse out that VAT tax. We will we'll give a rebate of 16.7% to the purchaser outside the country of Germany. On the other hand, if America wants to sell a car into Germany because we don't collect VAT tax, they will assume the VAT tax of similar value and they will slap that on at the point of import. So they would charge General Motors 16.7% on import into Germany, and they would discount Mercedes on export out of Germany. And that's why Germany is doing so well right now and why we're not. Does it make sense?
Yeah, and then you could have both then too, right?
You could have both, and in fact most countries do have both. By and large though, what has happened is that and many countries didn't used to reverse out the VAT tax as universally as they do, and they didn't used to apply it on imports as universally as they do. It was more just for internal, you know, use. Because they used to have higher tariffs. Most countries had tariffs in the 20% range at the very least up until the 1980s. But now that our tariffs are averaging around either 2.1% or 1.9%, it's somewhere in that range, right around 2%. And most European tariffs are, you know, with regard to the United States, are less than 2%. Now they're using VAT taxes as if it was a tariff, and we're not because we don't have a VAT tax. We're naked among all these countries. I believe China has a VAT tax. I might be wrong on that. They use regulations and rules, as the equivalent of, you must have a domestic partner and all these kind of things, the equivalent. Japan does, South Korea does, Taiwan does, Germany does, most European countries do. Most manufacturing countries have VAT taxes. Make sense?
Yeah, thanks a lot, Tom.
You're welcome. Thanks, Dave. Thanks for the call. It's always I always enjoy explaining that. KC, listening on KABQ in Albuquerque. What's up?
Hi there, Tom. Yeah, according to your story about Washington making law about the environment, I think we do need to have solar energy and wind energy on every federal building.
I agree. And that's something that...
In fact, I even have a plan that could fix the environment right now, but that's not what I called for. I called for because my wife was upset about the new minimum wage because she's been working at the same hospital for almost 20 years now. She makes close to $15, finally, using her college degree. Okay?
Right. Right.
And she's saying, well, wait a minute. If the minimum wage goes up to 15, what about me? And that's when I came up with my idea for a national holiday. Okay. We'll call it the 10-10-10. And it would promote and challenge every employer to give their employees a 10% raise.
Well, this is what happens when the minimum wage goes up, Casey. Tell your wife not to worry, because if the minimum wage, first of all, it's not going to go to $15. You're in Albuquerque. You're not in Seattle. So it's going to go to $10.10, and it's going to take 3 or 4 years to get there. And that's assuming that it ever gets through the Republican legislature, which is like fat chance, right? But if it did, then what has historically happened, and you can see this, I mean, we've had a minimum wage since the mid-30s, so and you know, it's over and over and over again, it's gotten raised, and we've seen the results of it. When the minimum wage is increased, then what happens is that all other wages rise by about that same percentage. It becomes the new floor, but everything above it echoes up. And because the economy gets stimulated by it, and because the demand for labor increases slightly as a consequence of it. So, not to worry. Tell her not to worry. In fact, she should support an increase in the minimum wage, because probably her $15 wage will become a $17 wage. KC, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Like, I got a whole minimum wage thing here someplace off the show in a few minutes about, you know, what we did, when, how, all of it was. Yeah, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Yeah, the muttering tease, indeed. I think I threw it away. Rats. I had a really good email somebody had sent me about, you know, what happens when the minimum wage goes up. And I thought I'd kept it in my keeper stack, but apparently I didn't. Oh, well. Back to the phone lines, as they say in the radio business. Eric in Newmarket, Tennessee, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Eric, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Man, where do I start? But anyhow, I've been depressed ever since Obama was elected. And I agree with just probably everything you say. And my problem is that we're not going to fix it the way we're going at it, and I'm not sure how to do it, but I know one way that we could do it, and that's if we could get the message out that, you know, I mean, for the last 150 years, there's been a game afoot, and that's how can the rich get what they want. And it's gotten to the point, crisis mode, where they're getting what they want. And the only way we can stop it, the last couple of good presidents, Jimmy Carter, and I'll give Obama the throw of the pitch there, said the people are going to have to step up and do it. So how about this midterm election, we vote a vote of no confidence by choosing to not participate in the auction that is participating as a government election in our country. Yeah. And by doing so, we are not, we're
Eric, that is you know, almost word for word, certainly concept for concept, out of the Republican playbook. This is exactly what the Republicans want you to say. And it's the reason why they run negative advertising. Negative advertising, you know, attack ads. Negative advertising does not cause people to vote for the candidate who is the opponent of the candidate who's being trashed. If you're running, if they run a negative ad against Obama, it doesn't cause people to vote for Romney. What it does is it causes people to say, "Ah, they're all crooks. Screw it. I'm not going to vote." And this is what they want.
That's my point.
As Paul Wehrick pointed out, as the voting populace goes down, Republican leverage goes up. And so if
we're participating in a crooked and a corrupt thing, once
you know, Eric, have you ever shown up at a Democratic Party meeting?
Man, I've been part of it. I call my elected.
No, I'm talking about showing up at the meeting. I have.
I've gone out. I've actually stood on the side of the road and pushed signs for the Democrats.
Yeah. Well, see, that's a different thing. I'm talking about getting on the inside, taking the damn thing over. You're right. In many places, the Democratic Party, much like the Republican Party, is basically an old boys club and it's corrupt. And the only way we're going to fix that is if we show up. If you show up and say, I'm going to run for precinct committee person, I want to be a member of the small club inside the Democratic Party that decides who the candidates are going to be in the primary, that decides what the platform is going to be for the party, that decides who we're going to send to Congress.
Yeah, but the whole system is broken, and we're all in agreement to that. So if we can get Republicans and Democrats to acknowledge that and just nobody show up and say, hey, look, this government
ain't gonna happen. Ain't gonna happen. Ain't gonna happen. I'm telling you, Eric. This, you know, your insistence on going back to that talking point over and over and over again makes me wonder if you're a Republican shill, because this is so much the message that the Republicans want out there, and it's one of the reasons why the Republicans love to fund people like I'm forgetting the libertarian Gary Johnson. Is that his name? I think. There's a couple of libertarians and fringe party candidates whose main sales pitch is, the system's so corrupt, vote for me, even though you're throwing your vote away. Doesn't work. Well, welcome back, Tom. I'm here with you. And Connor Boylan is on the line with us, the National Deputy Director of Progressive Democrats of America, PDAmerica.org. Hey, Connor, how are you?
Good, Tom. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for joining us. So PDA, I'm tonight after the TV show, I'm going to be hopping on an airplane to come up to see you guys. So tell everybody what's going on there tonight and tomorrow.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. Good to be with you. So we're on the ground here in Northampton, Massachusetts, and it's kind of a weekend of events, really. We're basically it's broken into two sections. So I know your listeners were our leader, Tim Carpenter, very well. He was often on your show. He unfortunately lost his battle with cancer just last week. And prior to him losing his battle, we'd arranged this event. It's our 10-year anniversary this year. So Progressive Democrats of America are 10 years old this weekend. So unfortunately, we lost him just before. It would have been so great to have him here this weekend. But as Tim, one of his famous words was onward. And, you know, he always pushed us, you know, to keep going. So this weekend will be kind of a celebration of the last 10 years, but also we're going to have a memorial for Tim, you know, to remember Tim. We're going to show like some slideshows and his family will be here. So, you know, it's going to be a good weekend. You know, it's going to be very much a good weekend for the progressive community. We're excited that Bernie Sanders will be joining us, for instance. He will be speaking. Tom, your good self will be joining us. Representative Jim McGovern will be joining us. Tom Hayden, Jim Hightower, America's favorite populist, Michael Leidy from the National Nurses United. So it's really going to be a great progressive gathering here in Massachusetts. And the fun will be starting tonight.
And John Nichols is going to be there?
John Nichols from The Nation magazine will, of course, be there. Yep.
So, and tonight, John and Bernie are doing a gig, right?
Yeah, tonight from 7 o'clock in Northampton. If any of your listeners are in the Northampton area, at the First Churches in Main Street, Northampton, it's going to be kind of an intimate gathering, kind of a one-on-one interview between John Nichols and Bernie Sanders. Mm-hmm. So that should be great to hear from Bernie, you know, where he's at right now, you know, fighting the good fight. And, you know, mm-hmm. to talk of Bernie maybe considering running for a president. So, you know, I'm sure that conversation will come up. So it's mm-hmm. going to be an interesting night tonight.
Right. And then tomorrow is basically the all-day event, the PD America all-day event. And then tomorrow night through WHMP, our local radio station there, WHMP.com, I'm going to be doing a book signing at the Parlor Room.
Parlor Room, yeah.
Yeah, on Saturday night at 7 o'clock. Mm-hmm. So, and that's the weekend, right?
That's the weekend, Tom, yeah. So starting again at 9 a.m. tomorrow, we're going to have, you know, Bernie will be back on again tomorrow and giving us a speech tomorrow. And then we're going to break it in. We're going to have some panels, some dialogue, with yourself on one of the media panels. We're going to be talking about shaping the media. And then there's going to be talking about how we can influence Congress. You know, I know a lot of people want to know how to kind of get active within their Democratic Party and how to push, you know, the Democrats to do the right thing. So we're going to have that conversation with the great Tom Hayden and Representative Jim McGovern from out here in Massachusetts, one of the good progressive Democrats we have in the House. So it promises to be a great event, and then we're going to have a memorial for Tim beginning at 3:30. Mm-hmm. It's free and open to the public, you know, where we're going to celebrates him. You know, we're going to have some laughs, we're going to have some tears, but, you know, I think he's going to be looking down on us tomorrow, seeing that we're celebrating his life, but also, you know, continuing the great work that he, you know, aspired to by launching Progressive Democrats this time 10 years ago, as we move forward for the next 10 years and how we might move forward.
Okay.
Without the great
so people can learn about it by going to pdamerica.org, and if they're in the neighborhood, if you're in the Northeast and you want to come over to Northampton, Mass, and hang out with Bernie and me and John Nichols and Jim Hightower and Jim McGovern and Connor Boylan and all these other great folks, all the details are there at pdamerica.org, and it starts tonight, and it's going to run through tomorrow. Tomorrow afternoon, it wraps up, what, around 5, 6, something like that, tomorrow night, tomorrow afternoon?
Yeah, about 6 o'clock tomorrow at night.
And then at 7 o'clock, David Pakman is going to introduce me, and I'm going to be doing a speech and then a book signing at the Parlor Room in Northampton collaboratively with our radio affiliate, WHMP, there. So sounds like a plan, Connor. Connor, thank you very much, and I look forward to seeing you tonight or tomorrow.
You bet, Tom. See you soon. Take
okay.
care.
Okay. Have a great one. Back to Anything Goes Friday. Ron, in Denver, you had a comment on Daryl Issa. Hey, thanks for listening to AM760, by the way.
You betcha. Good afternoon, Tom. Daryl Issa, the spearhead behind all these investigations, IRS, Benghazi, get so tired of hearing that crap. Here's a little information for the voters in San Diego per Wikipedia with many references. Here's a guy that joined the Army, couldn't even finish out his commitment to the Army, got a hardship discharge. After that, things really went downhill. Three times. Not once, not twice, three times. He was in front of a grand jury for car theft. He was not convicted of that, sorry to say. But he was convicted of concealed carry of a gun.
Right.
In Ohio. So this man is a carpetbagger to start with from Ohio to Southern California, where he made his richest, the richest man in Congress, on anti-car theft. Isn't that ironic?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. After being indicted three times for Grand Theft Auto, and there were one of his business partners alleged that he tried to burn down a warehouse for the insurance money, which launched his business. And his car alarms are made in China, and I mean it goes on and on. I mean it's totally bizarre. Ron, thank you for the Daryl Issa update. Appreciate it. Wren in Edmonds, Washington. We got a minute, Wren, until the end of this hour.
Okay,
it's
real quick. The Benghazi consulate was basically a CIA operations point.
Right.
So everything that went on there, by definition, is top secret. So the Obama administration can't just go up and say, yes, the CIA was doing this, this, and this top secret stuff there. And the top Republicans know it because they get all the briefings because they're on the on the in list.
Right.
So the administration can't. There's nothing they can fight back by saying, well, you guys are trying to force us into something that we can't talk about.
Right.
And they can keep it going forever as long as the. And then if they were to say something, then they'll beat them up for, oh, you broke national security.
Yep. Yeah. It's a real win-win for the Republicans, at least from their point of view, as long as they play the game relatively carefully, and I think they're going to. This guy, Trey Gowdy, that they put in charge of the investigation, he's a former federal prosecutor. He's not Louis Gohmert. Anyhow, Ren, thanks for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It is. I realize it's Anything Goes Friday. We normally just kind of throw it open to anything at all. And typically our first hour is Senator Sanders, has been for the last 8 years, where he takes your calls. Bernie will be with us in the next hour taking your calls. And because he's on his way to Northampton, Mass. For a gig tonight with John Nichols, and I'm going to be flying there tonight, and I will be there all day tomorrow for the PD America thing and the book signing tomorrow night. So anyhow, Bernie will be with us in the next hour. But I wanted to get our friend of the show, and I just think one of the smartest guys in the country here, Professor Stephen Cohen, contributing editor to The Nation, professor emeritus of Russian Studies and Politics at NYU and Princeton, the author of Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, which examines the new Cold War. It's out in paperback now. And the author of numerous pieces recently over at thenation.com on the topic of what's going on with Russia, the Ukraine, and all these this whole thing. Because there's been a fair amount of stuff. His most recent article was called Cold War Against Russia Without Debate. There's been a lot of stuff going on in the press. And I read a particularly disturbing piece in the New York Times yesterday. And I thought, boy, I'll bet Steve Cohen has something to say about this. Professor Cohen, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you for joining us. There's a number of memes floating around the American press that I wanted to get your take on. The first is this question of, you know, President Putin came out and said, well, you know, maybe you guys shouldn't, some of these cities that are occupied by the pro-Russian folks who are going to have an election apparently on May 15th, maybe you guys shouldn't do this quite so fast or do it at all. You know, and yesterday the big thing on CNN and every place else was, is this a head fake? Is it just a fake? Is he blinking? Is it, you know, what's going on?
I'm beginning to doubt or ask myself what the real purpose of American policy is. And since the mainstream media does not deviate from White House State Department policy, we get a reflection of the thinking of the White House and the State Department in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, CNN, MSNBC, down the road. Well, what happened 2 days ago? Putin made, in my judgment, an extraordinary statement. He opened the door to the way out of this crisis in Ukraine, which has already produced a new Cold War, and which could, if push comes to shove, lead to an American-Russian war. What did he say? Now, remember, he said this in the presence. I think the man is also the president of Switzerland, but he's now the rotational head of this European Organization on Security and Cooperation that people feel should step in, but it would have to be empowered by Russia, the United States, and the European Union. And here's what Putin said. Okay, he said, things are really getting bad in Ukraine. He was thinking of what happened in Odessa 1 week ago when 40 or more people were burned to death in a building. He looked into the future and he saw the horror of it all. And he said, all right, the West says my troops on the Ukrainian border, which have been there for months, are part of the problem. I will therefore, and no, he said, I have therefore moved them back away from the Ukrainian border. The White House and the State Department said, in effect, he's lying. We don't see the troops moving back. Then they amended it and said, well, we've got to wait till the satellite surveillance photos come in. Give me a break. We spend billions of dollars on satellite surveillance to tell us if somebody's launching a nuclear rocket. We got to wait a few days to find out. That's preposterous. Now, the second thing Putin said was, there's supposed to be a referendum in the Donbass, the Donetsk region. That's the largest region of East Ukraine. And it's supposed to be not the 15th, but this Sunday, Tom, the 11th.
Day after tomorrow.
There's only one question on the ballot. Do you approve of the creation of the People's Autonomous Republic of Donetsk? It doesn't really enact anything. It just says we've claimed an autonomous republic here. You support that. But that would mandate that area, which includes about 10 million people in Ukraine, to do what it wanted.
So is this the equivalent of what here in the United States we would refer to as a state, like Florida or New York, or is this more like a county? Or
well, it's not a state because our states have rights under our federal constitution.
Right, but I mean geographically.
Geographically, they call it a region. But, yeah, it's a state.
Yeah.
It's southeastern Ukraine.
Okay.
It's nearly a quarter of the population of the entire country, maybe a bit more.
Wow.
It's the industrial part of Ukraine. It's the hub of all those gas lines through which Russian natural gas flows to Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely critical part of Ukraine. And it's about the only profitable part of Ukraine. One of the protests, by the way, is no taxation without representation. Well, we've heard that. We had a revolution about that. They're saying they're sending all their profit to Kiev and they're getting nothing back. But one more thing, and then I'll stop, Tom. Because Putin said something completely unknown to me. It had never been reported. He said he had a telephone call with the Chancellor of Germany, Angela Merkel.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, Merkel proposes a round table, whatever that means. But, you know, a meeting. Of all the aggrieved parties inside Ukraine, that would be West Ukraine, that would be the capital, Kiev, and that would be the pro-Russian southeastern part of Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
He said she proposes that they sit down among themselves and decide the future of Ukraine, by which he meant a constitution. But this is what's astonishing. Merkel intervened, at least on the phone with Putin, and said she... And she's the most important leader of Europe, of the European Union, supports this. Putin said, I too support it. So you've got a puzzle here. Washington hasn't said a word about this, even though Merkel was in Washington last weekend, meeting with Obama.
Right.
The only thing reported was she's still unhappy about what we learned from Snowden, that the United States was tapping her cell phone. And they discussed Ukraine. But here is a breakthrough idea. It is a way out of the military crisis, this idea of a Ukrainian roundtable. And you would think everybody would jump right on there and say, yeah, let's do that. And what happened instead? Washington's silent, and today, as we talk, Tom, the Kiev government, which came to power not legally, and the Russians say is illegitimate, and we say is beautiful, that government launched an armor attack inside a city, and where there are office buildings and residential buildings and where parks where people live, they launched with heavy armor an attack inside the city to take back a police station that had been occupied. They crossed a Rubicon there because there's no way you could enter a city with a tank or just even heavy armor, anybody knows this, without killing non-combatants. Women, children, old people, animals, I mean, once you enter a city, atrocities are going to happen. And they did that today. Now, we don't have the details, but it appears that at least a dozen people are dead. And so that we control that government. Kiev does what we tell them to do and not to do. Mm-hmm. What is going on?
Wow.
I have to say, I don't think I would ever say this until I felt a form of despair, but I am beginning to wonder if the secret American policy is not to provoke Putin to the point where he does send troops into Ukraine. We say that's a no-no. Don't you ever do that. And we keep saying he's about to do it, though he's never done it. Right. And yet these provocations are putting him in a horrible position. And one last point, because I feel truly ashamed for my government. 1 week ago, when 40 people or more burned to death in that building, in Odessa, and it is both sides were responsible for the brawl in the streets that began, pro-Russian, anti-Russian. Guys were fighting. There had been a soccer game. People were drinking too much. But the this is in Odessa. The pro-Russian people ran to hide from the mob.
Professor, you're coming in by Skype, and as soon as the music starts, it kills the Skype. We're going to pick up that thought in just a moment. We've got to take a very quick break. We're talking with Professor Stephen Cohen, contributing editor with The Nation, Professor Emeritus of Russian Studies and Politics at New York University, NYU, and Princeton, and his most recent piece for The Nation, Cold War Against Russia. We'd like to pick.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be right back with Professor Cohen in just a moment. And welcome back. By the way, we're trying something new on our TV show. So if you're on Skype and want to ask me a question or make a comment, which will go into our Your Take, My Take live segment next week, Skype us right now, And our producers, Andrew and Nate, will record you, and we will play it on the air next Thursday on Your Take My Take Live. Our Skype ID is TalkToTom, TalkToTHom. That's our Skype ID. So if you have Skype and you want to ask a question for the TV show, for the evening TV show, do that right now. Back to Professor Cohen. Can you finish that thought, sir? I'm sorry, the music just squashed your audio.
I'm not technological. I got it now. And I apologize for seizing your own program from you and doing all the talking.
No, it's what I wanted you to do. I want to hear what you have to say. You're the expert.
Yes, because our media and our government are not telling the full story of what's going on. And when you don't tell the first story, that becomes a falsehood. So I'll go back to what happened at Odessa 1 week ago today. This mob, and there were these neo-Nazis from Western and Ukraine and Kiev in that mob. How many, we don't know. There are conflicting reports. These people fled into the building, including pregnant women. They showed her dead body later. Fled into this building. The people in the street threw Molotov cocktails. If people don't know what that is, that's a bottle of kerosene with a lit fuse that explodes into flame fury upon contact. Set the building on fire. And it appears that some of the people in the mob blocked the exits. People have died. Now, what did our government say? Did anybody in the State Department or the White House come out and say, we deeply mourn, we regret this, our sympathies to the families? Not a word of it. Here's what came from NATO, the White House, and the State Department. Kiev has a right to establish law and order. I mean, that's practically a justification for what those people did. And the New York Times reports in a story, there was a fire and people died in Kiev. That would be like saying some people died on 9/11 when a building collapsed. Yeah. I mean, it is simply incredible. And one last word, because it's May 9th, and this is the most sacred holiday in Russia, and everybody knows there's a big parade. It's earlier, it's almost over in Moscow. And Putin went to Crimea for a parade there. But just stop and think, if you're old enough, what people burned to death in a building evokes in the memory of an older generation. When the Nazis came into Russia and Belarus and Ukraine, all part of the Soviet Union, they would often round up the village, lock them in a barn, and burn the barn down. And it wasn't just Jews. That was a form of extermination that the Nazis used. So that burning building evoked horrible memories all across the former Soviet Union. And Putin himself mentioned it. He said, "Look with horror at the footage of what happened in Odessa. Cannot one of our leaders, a member of the Senate, of the House, of the State Department, of the White House, send sympathies from the American people?"
Yeah, particularly if this was not the government in Kiev asserting itself, but it was basically a brawl that turned into violence. It's astounding. We'll be right back with Dr. Stephen Cohen, Professor Stephen Cohen, contributing editor to The Nation, Professor Emeritus of Russian Studies and Politics at NYU and Princeton, author of Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, out in paperback, and also his latest piece for The Nation at thenation.com is Cold War Against Russia Without Debate. Stick around. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And just a quick note, we're doing something new on our TV show in the evenings, and we're taking calls in advance on Skype, video calls, and we'll record them, and then I'll answer them on the air. So if you've got a question that you would like to ask that I will answer on the air next Thursday on our Your Take, My Take Live segment, and you have Skype, use your Skype to call us right now between 4 and 4:30 Eastern Time. Nate and Andrew, our producers, are answering the Skype computer over at the television studios right now. And our Skype ID is TalkToTom, TalkToTHom. That's TalkToTom. So if you have a question or even a comment, you want to just do a rant, Skype into TalkToTom right now and anytime in the next 10 minutes. Professor Stephen Cohen is with us, contributing editor to The Nation, Professor Emeritus of Russian Study and Politics at NYU and Princeton. TheNation.com, his most recent article, Cold War Against Russia Without Debate, and a number of previous ones that are all well worthy of reading, and the author of the book Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives. Professor Cohen, I don't quite know where to begin with this. What are we to, as Americans, what are we to do? Oh, I know where I wanted to go. We spoke, did we not? I was in Germany the week before last. A friend of mine had a heart attack, and I went over the weekend. And we did a show right after that, and I mentioned to you that I was reading in the German newspapers a much more in-depth analysis of the Ukrainian situation than in America. Is that not the case? Am I remembering that correctly?
Evidently, your show is listened to by the New York Times. Did you notice? We did. You came back and said you had noticed that in the German press, I believe you said you read German.
I do.
You had noticed that in the German press there was a debate going on about the Ukrainian crisis.
Right, and a former German chancellor, in fact, was talking about it.
That's right, because three former German chancellors have criticized European policy more than they've criticized Putin's policy.
Right.
In this country, nobody opens their mouth, except I should amend that. I just saw, didn't see it on American television, but on RT, the English language Russian broadcast in this country, they did a report, and you're going to have to help me with his name, Representative Dana Rauschenbacher, right?
Rohrbacher, yeah, he's a Republican from California.
I gather that he doesn't have many views that I would agree with, but he grilled this woman from the State Department, Virginia Nuland, about what was going on in Ukraine, and he kept saying to her, because she had been in the streets, remember we caught her on, we didn't catch her, but we heard her on a tape planning the overthrow of the Yanukovych government.
Right.
He said to her, there are reports there were neo-fascists in the streets of Kiev that overthrew the government. Is that true? She was very evasive. He was very calm, great big guy, very calm, didn't raise his voice, but kept saying, but, you know, look at these photographs. Who are these? And she finally said, well, there were all kinds of people there. He is the only elected American official I know of who's challenged any official in our government about our policy and what's going on there. So, you know, applause where applause due. Back to Germany.
Mm-hmm.
You and I discussed that there was a debate in Germany.
Right.
So what pops up now on the New York Times op-ed page about 2 days after we talk? They found a German to explain why there's a debate in Germany.
Really?
And that's because 50% of Germans have been brainwashed by the left and the right, and therefore poor, deluded Germans, right, are having a debate because they're not informed like Americans. So squash the idea that there's a debate in Germany, because if there's a debate in Germany, some American may say, well, maybe we should have a debate here, and we don't. That was the point of the editorial in The Nation that Katrina VandenHeuvel, my wife, all disclosure, and I wrote, called Cold War Without Democracy. Democracy is supposed to produce a debate. We're having a debate on your broadcast, but it's not where it needs to be at the moment, inside the Beltway.
Yeah. Yeah. So the debate needs to be going on in Congress instead of another interminable hearing on Benghazi.
The media could smoke out our elected officials.
Mm-hmm.
I've done it before. In the run-up to the war in Iraq, I mean, questions were raised in the media about the State Department and the Bush administration's position. And then Congress people, other people began to say, let's discuss it.
Right.
It can be done if the media wants it done.
Well, it seems like the only way it'll be done. I mean, my take on Dana Rohrbacher is that he went after Victoria Nuland because he's a Republican and he was looking for some way to badly tar the State Department, which, you know, Hillary Clinton came out of, and she's probably going to run for president. I mean, there's a kind of secondary agenda here.
You know, you take your minor virtues where you find them.
I understand.
I don't know what his motivation is. I don't know the man. I understand that he holds very strong right-wing.
He's a hyper-partisan Republican.
But to be fair to him, for a long time, a couple of years, he's had the position that our policy toward Russia was unwise, and he led a bipartisan delegation to Russia, and joining him was my, I don't want to call him my namesake, but Steve Cohen of Tennessee.
Mm-hmm. Congressman
Steve Cohen went with him. So he seemed to have tried in the Congress to get some traction,
right,
for an alternative Russian policy. He failed, but if he wants to speak out in Congress against her at this moment of possible war, I think we should give him...
I'm with you. We have just one minute left here. What do you see as happening as we go forward?
I'm hoping that secretly or publicly in the next few days, the United States government embraces the overture that Putin made that I've described. If we do not, if we continue to allow the government in Kiev to attack these enclaves in eastern Ukraine, I worry that people much more hard-lined than Putin will persuade Putin he has no choice but to send troops into eastern Ukraine. All bets will be off then, because NATO troops will probably enter western Ukraine. That's the worst scenario.
Yeah, and then the people who are much more hardline than Obama will be advising Obama, and boom, we're in a World War One situation all over again.
Maybe you know what Obama thinks. It's a riddle to me.
I don't. I genuinely don't. I think on this he's lost. It seems, but I don't. You know, I'm very confused by the whole policy thing. Anyhow, we're out of time. But thank you so much for being with us this half hour, Professor Cohen. I appreciate it.
Yes,
thank you, Professor Stephen Cohen. You can read his work over at thenation.com. His most recent piece, "Cold War Against Russia Without Debate," and he's also the author of the book. Where did it go? Soviet Fates, thenation.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, which examines the new Cold War. Check it out. Stephen Cohen. It's Talk Media for the sane among us. Welcome back. Tom Hartman with us. That's new music, Shane. Just a different track. It's cool. I just have to play this for you. You know, the Supreme Court a couple days ago said public meetings paid for by the government on government property can be opened with a prayer. And the Senate has a long tradition of doing this. And so the Senate, apparently today, this might be yesterday, but I think it's today, opened their session with a prayer by a Hindu priest. And here is the first minute and 7 seconds of it. You will hear, I don't know if these are United States senators shouting this guy down or if these are people who were in the gallery, but this is pretty astounding. As the person who's standing in for the speaker invites the minister to give the invocation. Here it is.
Today's opening prayer will be offered by a guest chaplain, Mr. Rajan Zed of the Indian Association of Northern Nevada.
And as he walks up to the stage, a woman shouts,
Lord Jesus, forgive us, Father, for allowing the prayer of the wicked, which is an abomination in your sight, to be offered.
The sergeant-at-arms will restore order in the Senate.
We shall have no other gods before you. You are the one
who... The sergeant-at-arms will restore order in the chamber.
Let us pray. We meditate on the transcendental glory of the Deity Supreme, who...
The sergeant-at-arms will restore order in the Senate, in the chamber.
Let us pray. We meditate on the transcendental glory of the Deity Supreme, who is inside the heart of the earth, inside the life of the sky, and inside the soul of the heaven.
This is the beginning of the prayer, which is really a very beautiful prayer. But, you know, shout it down, you know, Lord God, forgive us for the wicked, for letting the wicked speak. It's like, phew, this country has just really, really gone over the edge. Libby with WAmend.org. Hey, Libby, what's up?
Hi, Tom. So glad to be on your show again. I just wanted to give everybody an update. You asked me to come back and give updates, and I'm happy to do that. We now are facing the fact that we have to hire paid signature gatherers at this point. We need to raise $400,000 to carry this forward and get it done, because we have to have all the signatures in by the end of June.
This is to get a ballot resolution encouraging the state of Washington to say, yes, we would like to have an amendment to the Constitution to say the money's not speech and corporations are not persons.
That's exactly right. Initiative 1329.
Right.
And if we do this by the end of June with enough signatures, we'll be on the November ballot.
Right.
And I just want everybody to know, please go to WAMEND.org and hit the donate button, and we will collect all of that, use what we have to do to get this job done here, and then we will pay it forward. Anything left over, we will pay forward to the next state doing a similar action.
Great.
We feel if we all hang together, we can really get this amendment done.
There you go. Libby Carr with W amend, or WAMEND, W as in Washington, amend.org. Thank you, Libby. And look, we will try to remind people of this periodically throughout the next few weeks. Lydia in Sevierville,
Tennessee. No, it's Sevier County, where the Great Smoky Mountains are. I thank you for all you do. I want to respond to the caller from Newmarket, which isn't very far from down the road from where I live.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a military mom. My son joined after 9/11. I'm asking him to get out and vote. Don't get discouraged. We're supporting Terry Adams. He's a veteran from Knoxville, Tennessee, mm-hmm. a Democrat running against Lamar Alexander.
Wow.
So I'm telling him, don't get discouraged. We're always busy raising money for candidates that's not even in our county to, you know, get things done. Mm-hmm. So.
That's great. So you're responding to the person who called about an hour ago who said, "Why? I'm not even going to bother to vote, and we should encourage everybody not to vote," by way of saying that we don't like this corrupted system. And I'm saying you are singing word for word the Republican hymnal. They don't want people to vote, and you're pushing back on him saying, "Yes, please get out and vote." Do I have that right, Lydia?
Because it's important because Lamar Alexander voted against supporting the veterans, and it's. And so did Bob Corker, but he's not running right now. But, you know, this is what we got in Tennessee. So,
yeah.
Anyway, I'm just asking, get out and vote. Don't get discouraged.
There you go. There you go.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Lydia. Great to hear from you, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Richard, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network in Dunnellan, Florida. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Well, Tom, I got a real surprise last week. I went to renew my heart drug.
Mm-hmm.
And it was $10 for a 3-month supply. Been taking it for 5 years.
Uh-huh.
It went to $84.81.
Yikes.
Yikes. That's 848% increase.
Yeah.
And all these folks in the country calling for less regulations on business, boy, that kind of goes against my grain.
Yeah. So, in other words, the drug company jacked the price up, right? This wasn't Obamacare that jacked the price up. This was the drug company.
Oh, no. Nothing to do with Obamacare. But I'm a veteran, and I made the transfer today to the VA.
Uh-huh.
And I'm probably alive talking to you today because of the VA.
Good.
They have done so much good. They've got problems. But name any organization or anything on this earth that doesn't have problems at any given time.
Yeah, I'm with you.
And it's unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah, it's amazing. Richard, thank you for calling and sharing your story. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Harvey, watching or listening to us over at TomHartmann.com in Berkeley, California. Hey, Harvey, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Well, I'm calling for a divestment of the Pacific Gas and Electric stock because their Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant has put all of America in harm's way.
Wait a minute. Diablo Canyon is owned by PG&E?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
And I'd like to tell you why. Because 25% of all the food that America eats comes from California Central Valley, the beans, the rice, the fruit, the cattle, the corn, the grapes. And Diablo Canyon sits in front of the Central Valley. And, you know, we're always told about the big one here, the big one. And Diablo Canyon, the big mega thrust earthquake like the one that happened at Fukushima, Diablo Canyon was only built for a 7.5 magnitude earthquake. Well, this week there was an article that says that there's record-breaking earthquakes on the Pacific Ring of Fire this week. According to the Pacific Tsunami Warning Center that issues alerts about tsunami, there were 13 earthquakes in April, and five of them were above 7.8. That exceeds the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant. And you know, if we get a real shaker here, a Fukushima-like shaker, a radioactive cloud of hydrogen will go up. It'll go back into the Central Valley. Also, because the plant is perched right at the edge of the sea, and if there's a meltdown, we'll get a continuous radioactive steam coming up from the water, from the aquifers below, blowing back into the Central Valley.
Right.
And, you know, if we
it would be like
food,
Fukushima, if Fukushima had been on the east coast instead of the west coast of Japan, instead of the prevailing winds carrying its radiation out to the ocean, it would be carrying it over the land.
That's right. And because of food insecurity now, droughts and so on, if we lose 25% of the food, that's why I say all of America is in jeopardy here. That, and this one plant only produces 7 to 10% of California's power. So I'm calling for a divestment because we need to close that plant and save America's food source.
Okay, you got it. Harvey, thanks a lot for the call. Jerry in Chicago, listen on WCPT. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm a first-time caller, long-time listener.
Thank you.
And I wanted to first thank you for the education I've gotten listening to you. I'm calling because you were talking about Benghazi and how we're into yet another investigation, and you brought up 9/11, and I'm in favor of another investigation into 9/11, specifically because of the scientific problems or what's been uncovered scientifically about the World Trade Center building collapses. Mm-hmm. Are you hearing me?
Yeah.
There's an organization called Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth.
Yes, I'm familiar with them. In fact, we've had people from that group on the program. It's been a few years, but I'm familiar with it.
That's great to hear. Richard Gage is the founder.
Yeah.
The science is pretty compelling that the only way those three buildings could have been brought down was via controlled demolition and not office fires, as is the official explanation.
Yeah.
This is especially true, I guess, of World Trade Center 7. I suppose there are still people who don't know about that building, but it was a 47-story building that was part of the World Trade Center complex that collapsed.
Right, and was not hit by an airplane. I'm familiar with all that. I'm not personally convinced by it, Jerry, but I'm familiar that there's a debate. I think that a more important debate is, why did George Bush get a warning on August 6th that this thing was coming and then refuse to go back to Washington, D.C.?
Well, that's true.
I want to know what George Bush knew and when he knew it. I want to know what Dick Cheney knew and when he knew it. I want to know what's going on. You know, this is the question. Jake Tapper asked this of Trey Gowdy, the guy who's going to be leading this Benghazi investigation. He said, you know, this is about four people who died in Benghazi. What about the 4,500 American soldiers who died in Iraq as a result of bad intelligence and lies and cover-ups by an administration? Why are we not talking about that? And of course, before Iraq, 9/11. Why are we not talking about that? So, Jerry, I don't share your perspective on 9/11, but I share your concern that we really don't know. There's so much we don't know, particularly the political end of it. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program, and Bernie will be with us in 15 minutes. And welcome back. Jackie in Missoula, Montana, watching us on Free Speech TV on cable. Hey, Jackie, what's up?
Hi, I'm so glad to have an opportunity to watch your show.
Thank you.
Very informative, and I love it.
Thank you.
But my comment is about war.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm encouraging is, if we're going to be in the middle of a war, whether it be as a result of 9/11 or if it's a result of any other cause, that our Congress people have their children serve on the front line instead of sending Native Americans to the front line because of their skills, or they recruit low-income people by offering scholarships.
Right.
So my thought is, what about equality on the front line?
I've had Charlie Rangel on this program probably six times on this topic. He's the congressman from northern New York City, from Harlem, and he's a vet of the Korean War, and a decorated veteran of the Korean War, and probably the most articulate spokesman in the United States Congress for bringing back the draft. And I absolutely agree. If we are going to have our military engaged in combat, frankly, anywhere in the world, if our young men and women are going to be coming home in body bags, we need to have a draft. And I would sweeten the pot by saying that there's a universal draft. You can, after you have done your year or 2 years of service to your country, you can choose to do it in the military or working for a nonprofit. Let's bring back the equivalent of Jimmy Carter's old CETA program, where you can go off and work for a nonprofit, any sort of 501c3 that qualifies, A. And B, after you have done your year or 2 years of service to your country, you then get a free college education or trade school education. And, you know, let's do it the way that the Europeans do it. And I'm totally with you, Jackie. I think it's a great idea. Thank you for calling and sharing that. Dave in South Range, Michigan. Hey, Dave, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite. What's up?
Oh, thanks for taking my call, Tom. I just wanted to point out, about the fact that the Republicans that are constantly going on about Benghazi, and they failed to appropriate the funds to protect these people overseas.
Mm-hmm.
So how can they, rail on the way they're going?
Yeah, well, see, nobody is asking that question. I mean, there are seven people who have now been appointed to the committee, and the large Republican majorities voted against increasing the budget for embassy securities on multiple occasions. I've not heard a single member of the corporate mainstream media ask the question, which of these seven members, what's the voting record of these seven members with regard to increasing the budget for embassy security? Not one. And I frankly don't know the answer. And, I'm guessing that, now that I'm mentioning it, and probably other people, great minds think alike and even mediocre minds sometimes, that other people on some of the blogs out there are going to be saying, hey, I wonder how these guys voted on embassy security. And probably that story will be showing up in the next 24 hours or next Monday on, places like the Daily Kos, Democratic Underground, Raw Story, Truth Out, Common Dreams, the regular progressive. But I don't know the answer to that question, and I would love to know it. So hopefully some good reporter is going to get on it, because there were multiple votes over the last few years to increase, at the request of the State Department, increase embassy security, and the Republicans said no. Welcome back. Tom Harmon here with you. Let's check in with Victoria Jones for the news of the day. Talk Radio News, the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsforTheOldGoat.com. And Victoria, welcome.
Thank you very much, Tom, and happy Europe Day.
This is, or the Russians call it Victory Day. This is VE Day, right? Victory in Europe Day, the day that the Europeans and the Russians and the Americans defeated Hitler?
No, this is a different day for Europeans.
Okay.
This is May the 9th. This is the day the European Union celebrates Europe Day to commemorate the day in 1950 when a French foreign minister, Robert Schuman, proposed consolidating the coal and steel industries of Europe to bind the nation so closely together that renewed war would be unthinkable.
Oh, that's interesting. So this was the step one toward the EU.
Correct. It was called the Schuman Declaration, considered to be the beginning of the creation of what is now the EU. And they celebrated in a big way, particularly at the embassies, where most of the embassies are open this weekend. You can just wander in.
Whoa. Here in D.C., you mean?
Here in D.C., yeah, they're open.
Huh. How about that?
Yeah. Yeah, and it's also the European Month of Culture in Washington, D.C., and the 28 member countries are putting on events at mm-hmm. the Kennedy Center and at their embassies. Nearly all of them are free that represent their countries. It's pretty amazing. There are like 80 events going on around the city that are highlighting the culture of Europe. It's kind of cool, but it's free, nearly all free.
Cool. As are most things in D.C., by the way, which is why it's such a great tourist town.
Yes, it's a good tourist town. So that was the happy news of the day.
Mm-hmm.
Moving along.
The other news of the day, the less happy news.
Less happy news. Amnesty International says that Nigeria's military had advanced warning of the attack on the town where some 270 girls were kidnapped, but they failed to act. Amnesty said it was told by credible sources that the military had more than 4 hours warning of the raid by Boko Haram militants. They say they were told by several people
that the military in Maiduguri, the capital of Borno State, was informed of the impending attack on Chibok Town soon after 7 o'clock in the evening local time. It says that a local official was contacted by several herdsmen who heard that armed men, who said that armed men had asked them where the government girls' secondary school was located in the town. And despite the warning, reinforcements were not sent to help protect the town in that remote area, which was attacked at around midnight, Amnesty says. And Amnesty says that one reason was a, quote, reported fear of engaging with the often better-equipped armed groups.
Wow. Wow. That's amazing. So, now there are two, as you know, being a talk radio host, I am on everybody's email list.
Yeah.
Including the talking point lists that go out to right-wing talk show hosts all across the country every day. And I got two interesting ones today. One is, and here's the headline, Will Benghazi hearings lead to impeachment? It's a pitch for a guest.
Yeah.
But basically it says this committee, the purpose of this committee that was just impaneled is to establish the basis for an impeachment vote against President Obama. The second one that I got has to do with Boko Haram, and it says, essentially, it asserts that Hillary Clinton made the decision, and I believe this to be true, not to list this group as a terrorist group, but they fail to mention that she did list the top three leaders as terrorists.
Correct.
But that she chose not to list this group as a terrorist group, and the State Department didn't do so until after she was no longer Secretary of State, and therefore she should be not only investigated but perhaps even prosecuted. All of this, of course, you know, Hillary bashing in anticipation of her running.
That doesn't make any difference, actually. I sound like Hillary saying, what difference, in fact, does that make?
Right.
That doesn't actually make any difference in terms of the Nigerian government's response to Boko Haram.
No, it doesn't make any difference to anything except in the Republican world of, oh, my God, look at how terrible Hillary is.
There is a New York Times story about this today. About that aspect, and it's quite interesting because they talk to some former officials who give the rationale, which I read it at 4 o'clock this morning, that was 13 hours ago, so I don't remember the rationale, who give the rationale for what the thinking was for not...
I think the main rationale was they did not want to elevate the status of this group. And then the secondary rationale was that the Nigerian military is so incompetent and so brutal that they were concerned that this might then force us to be providing support and military to the Nigerian military in a way that would be used not just against Boko Haram,
correct,
but against their own political opponents.
Correct. And if you think in terms of simplicity, oh, yes, if we designate them a terrorist organization, well, then suddenly something happens. Well, guess what? Al-Qaeda is a terrorist organization. I actually don't see Al-Qaeda around the world slowing down.
Right. They haven't suddenly vanished. Excellent point.
No, they haven't suddenly vanished. So, it is interesting, and I think
I predict that next week you're going to see a hearing on this coming out of Daryl Issa or somebody else.
Absolutely. And absolutely the Benghazi Committee ultimately about impeachment and stopping.
Do you happen to know the seven Republicans on this committee, if any of them voted not to increase funds for embassy security when the State Department and the administration requested it several times over the last few years?
I only heard their names within the last 2 hours.
So I
don't know that yet. A couple of them, Jim Jordan and Lynn Westmoreland, are extremely conservative. So it's very likely that they did vote against. But I don't know that.
Right.
Some of the others, I don't know the answers.
Okay. Well, we'll just wait. We'll wait to find out.
It will come out.
Yeah, I'm sure.
It will come out. Democrats have still not decided what they're going to do. They came out of a meeting today. I consider it a slap in the face that Representative Elijah Cummings of the proposals that Republicans made to them.
Yeah, I think they should put one guy on. The Democrats should appoint one guy, Alan Grayson.
Wow.
What do you think? I think that would work. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Bye now.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the third hour of our program. Normally in the first hour of our program, Senator Sanders is with us, but he was traveling to Northampton, Mass., where tonight he and John Nichols will be having an event. And this is all around the Progressive Democrats of America, pdamerica.org gig that's going to happen all day tomorrow. I will be there. John Nichols will be there. Jim Hightower is going to show up. And, of course, Senator Sanders and Congressman, help me out here, Bernie.
Jim McGovern.
Jim McGovern. Thank you. Congressman McGovern will be there. And then tomorrow night I'll be doing a book signing at the Parlor Room in Northampton, sponsored in part by WHMP, our affiliate there. So Bernie is with us in the third hour rather than the first hour. And Senator Sanders, welcome.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Thank you, sir. You have a list of things that are going on in Congress and around the country today, I'm sure.
Well, there are a number of issues out there. I am on a committee. I'm on both the Budget Committee and a committee called the Joint Economic Committee, which has House members and Senate members. And this week there was a hearing in which Janet Yellen attended. Janet Yellen, of course, is the new chairperson of the Fed. And I thought it was an interesting hearing, and I thought she did very well. The issue that I raise for her, what happens at these hearings is every member gets their 5 minutes and makes comments, asks questions. And the question that I asked her, which I think is an important question, is given the growing wealth and income inequality in America today, where the people on top are now earning something like 95% of all new income, and given the reality of Citizens United, which means that the Koch brothers and Sheldon Adelson and other billionaires can now spend unlimited, and that means hundreds of millions of dollars, to buy elections, would it be correct to define contemporary American society no longer as a democratic capitalist society, but as an oligarchic form of society? You know, when you reach a certain point, where the people on top have so much wealth and have so much power, and it's very hard to beat them. Is that really still a democratic society? And you may have noticed there was a study that came out maybe a week ago, 2 weeks ago, from some professors, I think, at Princeton University.
Yeah, Professor Gillens. We had him on this show.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
And I think the point that they made is, given the economic and political reality of today, does the voice and the needs of ordinary people resonate? Is government responding to their needs, or is government so overwhelmed by the power of big money and their lobbyist representatives that you really, for all intent and purposes, you know, might say that we don't live in a democratic society, but we live in an oligarchic form of society? I suspect that was the point that those professors made.
Yeah, Professor Gillens, when he was on, he explained his study and, you know, 1,800 pieces of legislation over 21 years and all this. And he said, we've concluded that basically it's not a democracy anymore. If you're in the top 10% of income and you want something done, or you're a corporation, a special interest group, it gets done. If you're in the 50th percentile in the middle, or in the 10th percentile at the bottom, the probability of what you want being done is the same as the as noise, as random noise.
Well, yeah, you know, and I, you know, sitting in the middle of all this in Washington, I mean, that's what I sense. I mean, it is very clear, and the polling tells us this. For example, do the American people in rather large numbers believe we should raise the minimum wage? And the answer is overwhelmingly
Yes, they do. Do the American people believe that we should give huge tax breaks to billionaires and large multinational corporations? And the American people say no. Do the American people think we should create millions of jobs to help us deal with unemployment, rebuild our infrastructure? The American people say yes. So on, do the American people think we should cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid? The American people say no. And yet on every one of those points, what the Republicans are pushing, I believe at the behest of the Koch brothers and other billionaires, is exactly opposite of what the American people want. And that's really remarkable. Now, how do they get away with it? Well, this is how they get away with it. There's going to be an election in about 6 months in November. And you know what the expectation is in terms of voter turnout?
Probably 35-40%.
Exactly. 40%. Yeah. Maybe less. So 60% of the American people don't vote. So if they don't vote, doesn't matter what they think or what they believe or what they need. Furthermore, if you look at that 60%, it is pretty clear that among the lowest income people in America, among many working class people in America, they don't vote in overwhelming numbers. So my guess is, I don't have any studies in front of me, but if you're talking about 60% of the people not voting, people with lesser education, people who are lower income are less likely to vote. So you're talking about 70 or 80% of those folks. So those people need to raise the minimum wage. They want to raise the minimum wage. Those people want an expansion of Medicaid, not cuts in Medicaid, but it doesn't matter what they want because they're not in the political process. And the challenge that we face is, how do we get them in the political process? And, of course, our Republican colleagues are working day and night to keep them out of the political process. And then you couple that reality of so many working people not voting with the fact that the billionaires can now spend unlimited sums of money to put 30-second ads on or minute ads on television to destroy people who they don't like or support people they do like. You have a very rigged system which suggests in many ways that the fundamentals of American democracy no longer exist, and you really are living, for all intents and purposes, in an oligarchic form of society.
Yeah.
So that was, I thought, and I thought Yellen was good in her responses.
She wouldn't say the word oligarchy, but she wouldn't deny it either.
Yeah, she didn't deny it. But, you know, there are limits to how far she will go.
Yeah.
But I thought she recognized the very serious problems of income and wealth inequality. Now, there's a couple of very, you know, talking about what the American people want and what they don't want. We tried to get the minimum wage passed the other week, and we got all of one Republican on board, just one Republican. And that is, you know, I think pretty pathetic. But I think what you're seeing all over this country is some Republicans, Tim Pawlenty, Minnesota, coming out and saying, I guess he thinks the minimum wage is a good idea. Others as well. So I think if we keep up the momentum, if we keep educating and getting the word out, we're going to put enough pressure on the Republicans so that at some point they're going to have to cave on that issue. Now, there is another issue coming down the pike, not exactly sure when, but within a short period of time, which is a huge issue. Every place I go, I hear about it, and that is the high cost of college education, the fact that many working-class young people now are choosing not to go to college because they don't want to get out of school $50,000 or $60,000 in debt, and the fact that we have millions of people who are struggling with very heavy indebtedness. I just was talking to some of the people in my own office, some of them are lawyers, and one young woman who was from Appalachia, actually, she said she is today $115,000 in debt. And another young lawyer has been, you know, she is been paying off her debt for years, and she will continue paying it off. She hasn't, you know, come anywhere near to completing her payments. So all over this country, you're seeing people who have gone to college, the graduate school. You know, if you go to medical school, you're not wealthy, you're going to come out a couple of $100,000 in debt. Law school, you know, $150,000 in debt. So you got a real, real crisis because we are now in a very competitive global economy. And what other countries do a lot better than we do is they say, you know what, we better make sure that our young people get the best education possible regardless of their income, or else we're going to be wasting a whole lot of intellectual talent. So what they do in many countries provide free higher education or heavily subsidized higher education. Now, in this country, we have programs like the Pell Grant, which are very, very good, the federal scholarships, if you like, but they're totally inadequate given the enormity of the problems that we face. So how you address high cost of college education, how you deal with student indebtedness, etc.,
huge issue
every day.
We'll be right back with Senator Sanders.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's Brunch with Bernie. 2 hours late here on Friday, so maybe it's Dinner with Bernie. But Senator Sanders will be taking your calls right after this. And welcome back. Senator Sanders, did you want to make any final points, or should we pick up some
phone calls? No, I think we're ready to go with the question.
All righty. Jesse, watching Free Speech TV in Miami, Florida. You are on the air, Senator Sanders.
Hi, Tom, Bernie. A belated happy birthday to Tom.
Thank you.
Bernie, please run for president.
Thanks very much.
Okay, Bernie, got some three tough questions for you. It relates to the owner that's in trouble with the basketball team.
Yep.
He says he's the way he is because of the culture. The three questions is, where did this culture come from? Does it represent the 1% today? And what is the solution to changing that culture? Because the only solution I could see could avoid a fake revolution or a fake World War III. So it's very important how we respond to this problem. This, you could see this racism thing is much is bigger than racism. So thank you, and happy Mother's Day to all, and everybody have a good weekend.
Okay, that's right. Let me echo that. Happy Mother's Day to all the mamas who are out there. You know, obviously what this guy said is, you know, beyond belief. It's based on ignorance and racism. Pure and simple. I wish we could agree that he was the only person in America who held those views. He is obviously not. I think what I would say to Jeff is, while we have got to continue all of our efforts to combat racism, and let's be honest and say that this country, in my view at least, has made real progress in the last many years. I always mention the fact that if I had a bet with some of my friends 20, 25 years ago, that not only would this country elect an African-American president, but re-elect him, people would have said, you're crazy, it never would have happened. But we have, you know, we still have a long, long way to go. And I think one of the issues that concerns me is that when the economy is bad, there are folks who play off one group against another group. And often that is anti-immigrant, it is anti-woman, it is anti-Hispanic, anti-African-American, or whatever it may be. So I think what we have got to do is bring our people together. We are all one. We are all part of the human race. No matter what our color is, we have to do well for all of our children. We have to try to understand the real causes of our problems, which to me has a lot to do with the power of big money, and let's stand together on those issues.
And the other, we have about 40 seconds, the other part of Jesse's question was, does Donald Sterling's comment, does that represent the worldview of the 1%?
No, I don't think it does. I think that would be unfair. I mean, I think often what the 1% is about is how they can make as much money as they possibly can. But I don't think it would be fair to say to the entire 1% that they're racist. I think that would not be correct.
Yeah. Although this guy did make a fortune as a slumlord and was very racist and discriminatory.
Yeah.
In fact, settled.
I mean, he is, and I'm not saying that there aren't others, but it's not just the 1%. Racism, you know, my problem with the 1% is that some of these people are not content, as with the case with the Koch brothers, to have $80 billion in profits.
Yeah.
That's not enough. They need more, and they want us to cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, or eliminate those programs in order to make them even richer.
Right.
But I don't think it's fair to say everybody was on 1%.
There you go. Okay. Senator Sanders is with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie, Dinner with Bernie here on the Tom Hartman Program. Back with your calls for Senator Sanders right after this. Welcome back Tom Harbin here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour, a couple of hours late, but we are live right now. It's 20 minutes after 5 here on the East Coast, and Senator Sanders on the line with us. And Larry in Vancouver, Washington, you are on the air, Senator Sanders.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time and the opportunity to speak. I'm concerned about Veterans Administration issues. I served twice, enlisted and officer both, and I actually retired from the VA. And I, you know, have a real hard time with people that don't agree with full funding of the VA for, you know, the airmen, soldiers, and that that put their life on the line.
Well, thank you, Larry, and let me respond as chairman of the Committee on Veterans Affairs. We have been working very, very hard during the last year for what many organizations feel is the most comprehensive piece of veterans legislation to be introduced in several decades. And we do a whole lot of things to make the VA stronger, to provide the kinds of benefits that not only veterans but their families need. One of the concerns that I have is that you have today 70, 72-year-old women who are home and have been taking care of their husbands who may have lost their legs in Vietnam, you know, a long, long, long time ago, and they've been doing it. They do it 7 days a week and 365 days a year. A couple of years ago, the Congress appropriately passed what we call a post-9/11 Caregivers Act, which gives help to those people who are taking care of the men and women who have been seriously injured in war. We want to expand that to the Vietnam-era generation, Korean War generation, World War II, etc. Having a hard time getting that passed. So I agree with Larry. I think, you know, in a democracy, we can debate about the wisdom of this or that war. I voted against the war in Iraq. I think it was a correct, history will record that as being an absolutely correct vote. But be that as it may, we got a lot of veterans out there from Iraq, Afghanistan, Korea, Vietnam, the Gulf, who are hurting, and we have a moral obligation to make sure they get all of the benefits to which they are entitled.
Paul in South Lyon, Michigan, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, thanks, gentlemen. The Republicans say they care about veterans, but when they vote in Congress, as you saw recently, they vote against helping veterans and in favor of protecting billionaires. The Republican record makes me think that they are behind the backlog at the VA, which is improving under President Obama in spite of Republican obstruction. How much have Republican budget cuts caused the problems that we're seeing at the VA?
Well, let's take a deep breath on this one. This is an issue I've been dealing with lately. And I think a lot of, and I appreciate Paul asking the question. And let me just say this, and I think all of the veterans organizations, the American Legion, DAV, VFW, Vietnam Vets, etc., would agree. President Obama has brought forth quite good budgets for the Veterans Administration. Under the Bush administration, there were times when the VA was really, really hurting in terms of their financial needs. But we have done better. And the result is that right now, I think if you go out and you ask the average veteran, they will tell you that VA health care, for example, is pretty good. It's pretty good. But what is not fully appreciated is that the VA is a huge system. And anytime you have a system which is treating some 6.2 million veterans, 6.2 million, today, Tom and Paul, there will be over 200,000 veterans walking into VA facilities today and on Monday and on Tuesday. So what sometimes happens when you have 200,000 people getting health care, if 95% of them were very, very happy with their health care, you would still have 10,000 people say, you know what, I didn't get good health care, or I didn't like my doctor or my nurse. But the bottom line is that what patient surveys show is that VA hangs in there pretty well, that the people who go into the VA medical centers and primary care facilities think VA provides pretty good health care. And in a lot of other areas, such as telehealth or prosthetics or complementary and alternative medicine or information technology, VA is often cutting edge. They're leading the rest of the country. So what my job is as chairman of the Senate Veterans Committee is to do everything that I can to protect the interests of our veterans, to make sure that we address all of the problems that exist. And in any time you have an institution which has 151 medical centers and 900 primary health care facilities, man, on any day, you're going to have a problem. Sometimes they're serious. But so does every other medical facility in America, and every other healthcare system have a problem. You know, what always amazes me is there was a study, Tom, you may recall this, I think it came out last year, published in a magazine called Patient Safety, and it was peer-reviewed and I think widely accepted, that in a given year, between 200,000 and 400,000 people die every year of preventable deaths in hospitals. Mm. Did you read that study?
Yeah, iatrogenic disease, yeah.
That's right. In other words, these are deaths that could have been prevented, but for one reason or another, maybe it was infection that should not have happened. Maybe it was the misuse of medicine. Maybe they got the wrong dosages or whatever, or other bad actions. 200,000 to 400,000 people die every year. So sometimes people look at the VA, and everything that happens in the VA is on the front pages of the newspaper because it has to be. It's public.
Yeah.
But you got a lot of private hospitals where people are also, you know, where there are also problems. So bottom line to me is VA is a strong medical system. Does a lot of good. There are problems. We want to address the problems. And we don't want to make this into a political issue because Obama is president.
Senator Bernie Sanders is with us, our Brunch with Bernie Hour. We are live. It's the third hour of our program today. Senator Sanders is in Northampton, Mass. He will be participating in the PDAmerica.org event tomorrow and tonight.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And be sure to check out Bernie's website and his Facebook page. You can find it all over at sanders.senate.gov. We'll be back with the senator and your calls for him right after this. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie, hour 2 hours late. So we are live. It is 28 minutes before the hour of 6 o'clock on the East Coast p.m. And Bernie is live in Northampton, Mass., where PDAmerica.org is having a gig tonight. He and John Nichols are going to be talking tomorrow, all day tomorrow. There's stuff going on. You can check it out at the PDAmerica.org website. And tomorrow night I'll be doing a book signing over at the Parlor Room, although I think it's sold out. And, Senator, you're still with us?
I am right here.
Okay, great. Jim in Scappoose, Oregon. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Bernie. Hi, Tom. Okay, I got a quick statement, and I got a question. I just read in a magazine right now in Fountain Valley, California, they're making hydrogen fuel from sewage. And in June, you can lease a Hyundai Tucson fuel-powered car for $500 a month. Now, here's my question. Would you filibuster the Keystone Pipeline to stop the tar sands pollution?
Well, it seems almost every day I'm being asked to filibuster one thing or the other. But, Jim, let me just say this. I am a strong, strong, strong opponent of the Keystone Pipeline, and some of us are working as hard as we can to get this thing defeated. And between you and me, I don't think Congress is going to pass it. I think we have the votes to stop it. And I will do everything I can to stop it. And here's the reason why. There are two main objections. And one objection, very important objection, is if this thing leaks, it could do devastating harms to water systems or aquifers, and that's a huge issue. But the more significant issue to me is whether or not we recognize what the scientific community is saying. And as you know, the scientific community just came out again, literally last week, and said, hey, you know, we're really far into this game, and we better get our act together. Because if we don't, we're looking at significant increases in the temperature of the Earth or the temperature of our ocean. And they're talking, you know, maybe 5-10 degrees by the end of the century, and that is catastrophic. And they're saying the damage is already taking place today. It's not tomorrow. It is now. So I think as a nation, we have got to lead the world in making it very clear the future is not with fossil fuel.
is not with tar sands. The future is with energy efficiency and sustainable energies like wind, solar, geothermal, biomass, and other technologies. And the good news is these technologies are developing and growing every day, getting better and better. Jim indicated that the price of, you know, getting hybrid cars or electric cars is going to go down, and I believe it will. We've got to invest in those technologies. That is the future of America. And when we do that, by the way, we not only help save the planet, we can lead China, we can lead Russia, India in that direction, and we can create a heck of a lot of jobs in America.
It's our national town hall meeting with Senator Sanders. Right now we have calls from Ohio, Illinois, Indiana, California, Florida, Illinois, New York, Nevada, Arkansas, and California.
You know what, Tom? That sounds like a national meeting to me.
It is, and that's just because we only have 12 lines. Every single one is full. Anthony in Hilliard, Ohio, you are on the air, Senator Sanders.
How you doing, Senator? Tom?
Good.
Got a couple questions. First of all, after finding out that Secretary Perez and Senator Heller wanted to work with Boehner on this unemployment extension that looks like it's going to lay dormant in the House, I mean, if they stuff this bill with more pork to get it through, what will happen if he just said no to everything, regardless to whether they want to try to compromise with this guy? I don't know. I just heard an hour ago that somebody threatened his life and his wife's life. The FBI arrested somebody. I mean, is this guy just that hard to work with? Could you tell me something?
Are we talking about Boehner?
Yeah. Why won't Boehner allow a vote on the unemployment extension?
I'm upset to hear that anyone would threaten anybody's life. But here's what you got, and I think, you know, people have got to understand this, and I think they're not comfortable understanding it, but it's just simply the truth. The Republican Party of today is not your father's Republican Party or your grandfather's Republican Party. Historically in this country, or at least in the modern history of this country, the Republican Party was what we would call a center-right party, a kind of conservative, moderate party. Today, over the last 30 years, the party has evolved into being a right-wing extremist party, in my view, a very right-wing party. And a lot of that reason has to do with the power of huge, very, very wealthy and powerful special interests like the Koch brothers. And I mentioned on this show, and we've written articles on this, I was just on the floor the other day, and the media, not surprisingly, Tom, the corporate media doesn't really talk about this very much. But people have to know what the Koch brothers believe, because they are spending hundreds of millions of dollars. It's not John Boehner. John Boehner's members are receiving these campaign contributions from groups who believe ultimately that we should end Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and public education and the U.S. Postal Service, that we should completely repeal all federal campaign finance laws, which means that billionaires can give directly to individual candidates. And these guys have as much money as it takes. The Koch brothers are worth $80 billion. They made $12 billion last year. So for them to spend a few billion dollars on elections is like somebody else going out to dinner. It's nothing. And these guys are pushing a right-wing agenda, and Republicans are listening to that agenda. So it's not John Boehner. It is the big money and the right-wing money of billionaires who want to move this country in a direction very, very different from where the American people want to go. And the sooner we begin to understand that, the better it will be. These guys, among other things, we talked about climate change. The Koch brothers and others are spending huge sums of money fighting every initiative that will transform our energy system away from fossil fuel.
John in Chicago, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, hey, Bernie, you need to run for president. We need a guy with the brass that you have. My question to you is, you know, with minimum wage being $7.25 and these sleazeball corporations not even wanting to pay people that, what they do, like, say, Princess Cruise Line, for example, they actually source out the work to other companies, and then those companies employ people for, like, $3 an hour, so you work for, like, 9 months. And only get like $7,000 and work 20 hours a day, 7 days a week. And it's a legal form of slavery that's even more cruel than the $7.25. Why can't these corporations pay at least American minimum wage if they're outsourcing their work and they're still working for an American corporation considered an American, on an American vessel? I hope that's your answer. Thank you.
Well, my answer is very, very short. You're right. You're exactly right. If these guys want to avoid paying the starvation minimum wage in the United States of America, $7.25 an hour, and want to run to other countries, they should pay at least the American minimum wage.
Adam A. in Bloomington, Indiana. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi. The guy beat me to my question there. That was one of my questions about the minimum wage. And I want to thank Mr. Sanders for his service. And I saw on TV the other day when he said that we do not have a democracy. We have a capitalist oligarchy.
Yeah.
I was very, very impressed with that. And we do need to pay people a living wage, because I know so many people that are working two and three jobs, working for minimum wage, trying to get the rent paid, and the rent keeps going up and up and up.
So, Adam A., your question for Bernie?
Well, Adam A. makes the exact right point. And that's what we should be talking about day after day after day. And that is that you have a situation where median family income has gone down by $5,000 since 1999, despite the huge increase in productivity, where you have older workers whose jobs have gone to China or wherever are now working at jobs that pay them 50% of what they formerly earned. We got millions of people working for $7.50 an hour or $8 an hour, can't afford to take care of their families, and we're living at a time when most of the new jobs are being created are low-wage, part-time jobs. That's just the simple fact. So the challenge that we face is not only how do we create the millions of jobs that we need, because real unemployment is close to 12%. It's not 6.3% if you count those people who have given up looking for work and are working part-time. And how do we make sure that the new jobs that we create pay people a living wage, a living wage? And among many other things we have to do is end this disastrous trade policy, which enables companies to go to China or Vietnam or Mexico. They want us to buy their products. Turn on TV tonight, you're going to see 100 ads. Buy this, buy that, buy that. Well, if they want us to buy their products, they should be manufacturing those products here in the United States of America, not in China, et cetera. And second of all, you know, we need to strengthen the trade union movement so that workers have a better opportunity to be able to organize and bargain collectively for their wages. And the union movement right now has been beaten up pretty bad by corporate America in the last few years. So there's a lot of work to be done. But as Anna May points out, we have a middle class which is really hurting today, and we have got to address that issue.
It's our Brunch with Bernie hour, 2 hours late today, but we're here and we're live. We will be back with more of your questions for Senator Sanders right after this. Be sure to check out Bernie's website and his Facebook page. You can get there off sanders.senate.gov. And, of course, on Facebook, just search Bernie Sanders. We'll be right back. It's 15 minutes before you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And also TomHartman.com. We've got a message board and a free chat room. And drop in there, too. And welcome back, John, in... How do you say that town, Cayucos, California, John?
Cayucos.
Cayucos.
Yeah, Cayucos.
Watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network. You're on the air with Senator Sanders. Yes.
Thank you, Senator, and thank you, Tom. I have a quick question. That was glad to hear what you said about Keystone, that you think that there's a good possibility it may not be approved. But in case it is, what are the chances that as it meanders through the central United States that each state can tax TransCanada as it crosses into their state at their border? And the point being the solution, hopefully, that we can tax it out of existence.
Well, I think that's a decision that has to be made by the people in those states. And I know that in a number of states there are environmental concerns. What happens if the pipe breaks and you have, you know, a huge amount of oil leaking? What does that mean to the aquifer, with people that are dependent upon that water? So these are, and other issues. So, you know, these are issues that I think, you know, any American citizen has the right to raise, and it's one tactic out there. But to me, again, the fundamental issue here is whether we recognize what the scientific community is saying and act aggressively. And acting aggressively means you do not support a Keystone pipeline.
Roger in Jennings, Florida, listening on TuneIn on Progressive Voices. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Senator Sanders. I have an interesting question for you, and I'd like to shortly follow up on your response, if I may. If I were to ask you, where do you think the formula for the reactivation of the American people, if there is a magic formula, and if there is a person that can really inspire this reactivation? Do you think that there are any limits in terms of where this person might come from? Could this person be a very ordinary person? Must this person be someone in public office? In other words, do you have any limits in your mind as to where this formula might be and this person? And
let me just say this, Roger. I first of all don't believe that there's any magic formula. I really don't, and I think that's very wishful thinking. Second of all, do I think that the kind of leadership that we need to rally the American people to a society in which we live with justice and dignity for all people, do I think that has to come from a public official? No, I certainly do not. There are millions of fantastic people in this country who have the trust and the respect of their coworkers and people in their communities. And any and all of those people have the potential to be great leaders. But I am not a great, I got to tell you, I'm not a great believer in the theory that one person is going to change the world. It doesn't happen that way. What one person can help do is get hundreds of other people and then thousands of other people to become energized. We change the world when political consciousness changes, when people say, hey, enough is enough. I'm not going to take it anymore. I'm working really hard. My family is entitled to health care, to education, to decent housing, to dignity. When people wake up and say that's what they want, we change the world. And I think there are thousands of people, certainly people who have never held an elected position are included in that number, who will be great in doing that. And that's what we have to focus on.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. We'll be back with more of your questions for Senator Sanders right after this. Before the hour, welcome back, Senator Bernie Sanders, taking your questions in our National Town Hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie. Aaron in Midlothian, Virginia, watching or listening or something, it says on Twitter. Aaron, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, hello.
Hi. You're on, Aaron. Hello? What's your question?
Oh, okay. My question is, if elected, what will you do about the FCC's plan to restructure net neutrality and online traffic?
Well, I'm not sure I'm going to run, son. That's a little bit of premature. I'm giving thought to running for president. But, you know, when you have the political views that I have and you don't have billions of dollars behind you, it's a difficult decision to make. But let me just say a word about net neutrality. I think the Internet has been an extraordinary advance for democracy, in the sense that anybody, you don't have to have a whole lot of money, but you have access to a computer, you can get out there. You can express your point of view. You can develop a blog. You can develop a website. If you're a small business, it can really work for you. You don't have to be, you know, Sears or Macy's. You can be a small business and use the Internet to your advantage. And the strength of the Internet up until now is that all people are treated equally. And it's not a question of, you know, the New York Times going to Comcast and say, well, yeah, I'll give you $1 million and I want high speed and some little guy has a much slower speed. That's not what the Internet is. So I believe very, very strongly about this issue. and we are going to do everything that we can to oppose this proposed ruling, which will end the internet as we know it.
Mark in Chico, California, you're on the air with Senator Sanders. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Mark? Mark is apparently listening to his TV, not his phone. Brian in Chicago, thanks for listening to WCPT. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Well, thank you for taking my call. First, Senator Sanders, please do run. We need you. I understand that, you know, there's financial challenges, but as a millennial, I'm 23. We need you right now.
Brian, thank you very much. And let me throw something back to you. Where I need you, the country needs your generation. In this coming election, my guess is 70% of people your age will not vote. So I beg of you, do everything that you can to make people your age, young people, the future of this country, aware how important politics is. All right, Brian, your question, not mine.
Of course. I'm thinking about going back to school. I have a bachelor's right now in order to become a doctor in psychology to serve underserved populations. Yeah, sure. Such as you know, West Side of Chicago or refugees or whatnot. However, that's very expensive to do, especially with privatized education, which is what's available in my area. Now, this federal government has a loan forgiveness program, like you make minimum payments after 10 years and they'll forgive your debt. However, I'm not sure about the current attitude toward those programs in Congress, given that they're cutting unemployment benefits. And if the Congress remains the same way it is after the elections, you know, deeply divided, Republicans want to take on social programs to reduce the deficit, what chance do you think those will last in the long term, whereas they, you know, cut it and then I'm left with, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars?
Here are a couple of programs. There's one program, and I worked very, very hard with Senator Harkin and others in terms of the Affordable Care Act, and Majority Leader Reid was very strong, where we tripled funding for a program called the National Health Service Corps. And what that program says, if you are prepared to do, as you've just indicated, you want to do, work professionally as a doctor, a psychologist, a dentist, in underserved areas around the country, there will be debt forgiveness for you. So if you give 5 years to those communities, it is likely that all or a lot of your debt will be paid off, at least your graduate school debt. That's one program. There's another program out there that if you work for 10 years for a nonprofit, you will also get some debt forgiveness. Now, what the future of these programs are, you know, who can predict? But I think given the crisis that we face in healthcare, especially in primary care and underserved areas, I do not believe that those I certainly hope very much and don't think that they will be cut.
Okay. Anthony in Greenlawn, New York, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Senator. I am doing what I can. I was involved with Occupy Wall Street and still do a lot of activism things outside of my regular job as a social worker. But I and a lot of people that I know have lost complete faith in the Democratic Party.
Yep.
You are absolutely wonderful. And
just a heads up, guys, there's 1 minute left in the hour here.
Okay. On all the issues, whether it's cutting food stamps or ignoring climate change for 4 years, they're on the wrong side and they're in the pocket of Wall Street. Why should I bother with the Democratic Party and not build a third party?
Well, let me, Anthony, great question, and we're not going to have enough time to answer it. I've got a few seconds here.
We've got about a minute.
I am an independent, have always operated outside the two major parties. But let me just say this to you. Building a third party, honestly, is a lot harder than it looks on paper. In Vermont, we have probably done better than any other state in the country in building a progressive third party. We have good representation in the state legislature, have had a significant influence on public policy in the legislature, and I come out of that effort. It ain't easy. The other thing that I would say is when you look at the Democratic Party, there are Democrats and there are Democrats. There are some Democrats, not a whole lot different than Republicans. There are some Democrats who are working day and night for all the right things that you probably agree with. So there's a line of argument that says we should, in a sense, Tea Party, the Democratic Party, make it into a progressive body. There are other people who suggest, as Anthony does, that it's really too late to help us go independent.
it is a debate that where I am right now, and I suspect I'm going to be hearing some of that debate in the next couple of days. But that's kind of the two sides of that story.
Senator Sanders, thanks for being with us today.
Okay, Tom, great to be with you. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Always great to have you. And don't forget Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. And thank you all so much for being with us throughout the day, throughout the week. Have a great weekend. And if you're in Northampton, Mass., I'll see you tomorrow. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag your it. See you next week.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.